This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If one of America's favorite sports is criticizing politicians, another is criticizing how the media covers politicians. My guest Tom Rosenstiel has been keeping score on both fronts. He's the media and political correspondent for the LA Times. During the 1992 presidential campaign, he wanted to see how the media shaped the race. He focused on ABC News, where he was given behind-the-scenes access to story meetings, editing bays, and other editorial discussions. Rosenstiel's new book is called Strange Bedfellows, How Television and the Presidential Candidates Changed American Politics in 1992. He says that network TV has lost some of its power to cable and, more surprisingly, to local affiliates.
That happened over the last decade, and one of the seminal events that is mostly unknown in television and in American culture was that when CNN came along, they started selling their footage to local affiliates all across the country. And what that did is it revolutionized, in many ways, the dissemination of information in the United States, because before that, the networks essentially had a monopoly over national news on television. A CBS affiliate couldn't get CBS footage of events from around the world or around the country until after they had appeared on the CBS Evening News, and that was true at all three networks. CNN broke that monopoly, and in a sense, shortly thereafter, forced the three commercial networks to begin selling their footage in advance of their own newscasts to their affiliates to make it available, so that suddenly local news all around the country by the mid-80s was capable of providing all the national news that people were going to see that once belonged exclusively to the networks.
Candidate Clinton helped the local TV stations too by doing satellite press conferences with local anchors and local reporters. Do candidates and politicians in general sometimes prefer talking to local affiliates rather than the network people?
A presidential election should be split into two parts. First, there is the primary section, which is, in a sense, a series of local campaigns. And in those campaigns, nothing works like local television or local radio, because you can address local concerns, you can make it relevant to the community, and generally there is a presumption on the part of politicians that local anchormen, while they may be bright and may be good newsmen and women, are not as familiar with the national issues that a candidate is talking about. So the candidate has greater control. In other words, he can do a better snow job. There is also a presumption which the Clinton campaign and the Bush campaign came to firmly believe in 1992, which is that audiences identify now more with their local media than they do with the national press. They view the national media and national networks, national newspapers, as part of that elite establishment from which citizens feel alienated in general. But the local newsman, my local, you know, Bill Bonds in Detroit, he's a guy I trust, and, you know, he's the guy who gives me my news. Well, you don't feel that Peter Jennings giving you your news, that he's your newsman. So the greater local identification that audiences have with local news people is something that the candidates now, not just the two candidates in 92, but across the board, feel it works tremendously to their advantage. Not only do they have more control over these guys, but audiences believe these guys more.
Another part of the story that took away some of the power from network TV was radio. You found, for instance, that candidate Clinton's press staff developed an 800 number for radio sound bites.
They had a system, and it all developed by accident. They basically started out with a college intern in New Hampshire named Richard Strauss, who decided to take a leave of absence from UCLA and join the Clinton campaign. And he started trailing Clinton around with his portable tape player, and found that local radio stations around New Hampshire were delighted to have what we call actualities, little sound bites from Clinton's appearances that day. By the fall, when the November election was getting close, the Clinton campaign had developed a computer switching system that they had in Little Rock, by which any local radio station around the country could call in, and a computer would answer and say, "Hello, this is the Clinton hotline. If you want an actuality from Bill Clinton, press 1. If you want an actuality from Al Gore, press 2. If you want Hillary Clinton, press 3. If you'd like something for Hispanic stations, press 4. If you want something for black stations, press 5. And if you want something for college stations, press 6. And then whatever number you press, they had sound bites from those days' events that were tailored to those markets. And no human hand was involved in that switching process. In the Clinton campaign, it was all computerized.
It's a pretty good definition of managing the news.
Or at least supplying the demand.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Rosensteel, author of the new book Strange Bedfellows, How TV and the Presidential Candidates Changed American Politics in 1992. He's a media and political correspondent for the L.A. Times. Something interesting you reported on was that candidate Clinton sought the advice of journalists during the campaign. A lot of journalists worried that this could compromise them by making them insiders instead of outsiders watching what was happening. What kind of advice did Clinton seek from journalists, and what kinds of journalists did he seek out?
Well, in the early stages of the campaign, in the fall of 1991, something takes place now that might best be called the invisible primary. And this is the period of time in which the candidates are scrambling to be defined as serious, to be defined as people who have a real chance of winning the nomination. And who decides who and who sorts out the race in this invisible primary is no longer the parties, which aren't really strong enough to have party bosses and to sort out the candidates. To a large degree, it is the media. And Bill Clinton understood that, and what he did was that he would seek out reporters and seek their advice, ask them about theories they had about politics, and he would seek out the most influential reporters at major magazines or journals of opinion around the country, increasingly, journalists find themselves in the role in general now of being interested not just in reporting the news, but in really trying to shape the direction of political parties or trying to come up with ideas about how, the direction of policy. So you had people like E.J. Dionne, who's a reporter at the Washington Post, who'd written a book called Why People Hate Politics. That was a history of the parties of the last 25 years and a prescription for where the two parties should be headed. Well, Clinton would go so far as to talk about the book on the stump and refer to my good friend E.J. Dionne, while Dionne was down there in the pit with the rest of the reporters taking notes supposedly covering the event. There were others. Joe Klein, who was an influential reporter at New York Magazine who then went to Newsweek, has written powerfully about the failure of the Great Society and some of the social programs of the Democratic Party in the 60s and the direction that the Democratic Party should go. And Clinton sought his advice out. Interviews that these reporters would do, they told me, would quickly sort of evolve into a dialogue in which they realized that the Clinton was trying to sort of seduce them and flatter them by seeking their ideas. One reporter, a friend of mine at the LA Times named Ron Brownstein, called it the invisible circle of complicity, in which the candidate would call you up after a story had run to talk more about your ideas about things. It was a way for Clinton to both find out where the press was headed to gather information, but also a way to seduce the press into thinking, this guy, Bill Clinton, he's a smart guy.
Did some of the journalists say no?
Some of the journalists, I'm told by Clinton aides, were much more formal about this process than others. E.J. Dionne, for instance, when he was interviewing Clinton, those were much more formal interviews. with Joe Klein at New York Magazine, it was a fuzzier kind of process. With Michael Kremer at Time Magazine, I'm told, these were more like dialogues than interviews. Sidney Blumenthal at the New Republic, now at the New Yorker, who wrote an influential cover piece about Clinton at a pivotal time in the early days of the campaign, even would describe himself as an informal advisor to the Clinton camp, which, as one Clinton advisor said to me later, that was generous.
My guest is Tom Rosenstiel, media and political correspondent for the LA Times and author of the new book, Strange Bedfellows, How TV and the Presidential Candidates Changed American Politics in 1992. Tom, let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tom Rosenstiel, author of the new book Strange Bedfellows, about how TV covered the 1992 presidential campaign. When the Jennifer Flowers story broke during the primaries, there was obviously a lot of debate in the media about whether this was a legitimate story or just a tabloid story, and, you know, whether it should be covered or not. What kinds of editorial discussions did you hear behind the scenes at ABC on that subject?
Well, when the Jennifer Flowers story broke, it happened this way. It first broke in something called the Star, which is a supermarket tabloid. And an ABC off-air researcher got a hold of this story. It was faxed to him by the news desk at ABC in New York. He was traveling with Clinton in New Hampshire, and he corralled Clinton in a Manchester hotel lobby and showed him the story and said, "We're going to ask you about this later." So Clinton was then on notice that this thing had appeared and that the national press, even though it was just a supermarket tabloid, had gotten a hold of it. This off-air researcher, whose name is Mark Halperin, then rode in a van with other reporters to Clinton's next event, which was at a brush factory upstate New Hampshire. And in that van, he showed them the supermarket tabloid story. So he had shared this story with them and given it a kind of momentum. And then inside the brush factory, which was in the foyer of the brush factory, which was about an 8x12 sized room, all these reporters then were sort of loaded for bear to ask Clinton about this thing, in part because ABC had distributed it. Clinton arrives at the brush factory and the lights go on. You know, the camera is about 8 inches from his face, and he's asked, you know, who's the woman? What is it true? You know, a question after question before he's able to answer one question, the next question is coming at him. And this exchange, in fact, I sort of just go through it verbatim in the book because it's terrifying to read. The tape comes back to New York via satellite, and Jim Wooten, the ABC correspondent, gets on a cell phone in his car, a cellular phone, and starts describing what happened and that the tape is on its way. And on the rim at ABC in New York, they start having a debate. Is adultery an issue? Should we deal with a man's private life? Is it relevant to his public character? Has this story been substantiated or has it not? And this was, you know, like a college seminar. There were people on all sides, and there were Peter Jennings, chief political researcher, and a woman named Nancy Gabriner says, you know, let's not do this. This is wrong. It doesn't matter. It's none of our business. It doesn't say anything about public character. And Jeff Greenfield, a correspondent for Nightline and for ABC's World News Tonight, who himself was ambivalent about this, is arguing, look, the adultery is the, you know, is one of the Ten Commandments. Is it not relevant if someone is breaking one of the, you know, is committing a cardinal sin? Who are we to decide that it's not relevant for our audience? And they basically didn't know what to do. And what they ended up deciding that first night was, let's pass. Let's not deal with the Jennifer Flowers story. Now, the same decision was made at all three networks that first night. It was a Thursday. And the producers of those programs went home that night. And at 11 o'clock at night, they turned on their local late news. And the Jennifer Flowers story was leading the newscast in local broadcasts all across the country. And they recognized that by the next morning they were losing control of the story. The networks and the New York Times and the great media institutions in the country no longer had the power to control the news agenda or even to set the news standards for the rest of the country.
Some interesting stories about Perot. It seems like ABC wasn't very interested, really, in covering him at the beginning. I mean, you tell a story about how Perot was on the Brinkley Show one Sunday morning, and everybody on the show found him completely incoherent. They didn't want to have him on again. And then there was a behind-the-scenes meeting with Jennings and other news guys and executives at ABC. Tell us what happened at that meeting.
This was a meeting at Ruin Arledge's house where they were discovering that this campaign had gone off in a direction that they just had not prepared for. Stepping back for a moment, Perot appeared on Larry King on February 20th, 2 days after the New Hampshire primary. And almost 2 months went by before the mainstream media, anywhere in the mainstream media, did a story about Perot of any magnitude. By the time that the mainstream media began to recognize Perot, he was already at 20% in the polls. And that had happened through talk radio and interactive media like Larry King, through the subterrain of new media, shows that Peter Jennings and Rune Arledge and the rest of the people at ABC had never heard of. So this meeting in late May at Arledge's house was to take stock of the fact that this campaign had sort of spiraled out of their, not only out of their reach, but out of their understanding. And Rune Arledge in particular argues that they should do, to catch up, they should do an hour-long special examining who Perot is and giving his biography, and then afterwards they should invite Perot on for a lengthy live town hall for Perot to interact with a live studio audience and do his thing on ABC for the rest of the nation. The plans go into effect to do this, and in the meantime, the investigative team at ABC starts gearing up to look into Perot, and a reporter is assigned to cover Perot. And what happened in the weeks that followed revealed an enormous amount about Ross Perot that was terrifying and fascinating to the people at ABC, and none of it ever got on the air, virtually.
What did Perot say behind the scenes that you think he might not have wanted to say had the cameras been on?
Well, for one thing, as they were leading up to this hour-long special, Perot started calling the people at ABC, desperately paranoid about the fact that the live studio audience at this town hall might be a stacked deck, that they might be Republican plants from what he called the Republican hit attack machine, and that ABC was out to destroy Perot for the sake of its own ratings. And he said that he'd been warned by the beautiful people in New York that this is what was going to happen. And when the people at ABC said to him, you know, what are you talking about? Who are the beautiful people in New York? You know, what do you mean? He said, well, maybe it's just been leaked to me by the Republican hit machine that this is going to happen because they're trying to prey on my mind. You know, that's what they do. They prey on your mind, and it's working. And the people at ABC, and these are private conversations, were like appalled. What the executive producer of that particular program had been someone who was interested in Perot and perhaps, you know, voting for Perot. But this 25-minute conversation with him, with Perot, put off this executive that he lost all interest in Perot as a potential political figure.
Did anyone at NBC really feel that it was their job to expose Perot for being, you know, muddle-headed and paranoid, the kinds of behavior he was exhibiting behind the scenes to them?
Well, one of the points that I make in the book, or try to make, is that one role that the press plays that's very important is that the reporters out on the campaign trail are close to a candidate. They can pick up things that you can't get through the false intimacy of television. They are there. They have personal contact. And they were beginning through all these contacts to come to these conclusions about Perot, and they were gearing up with a series of investigative reports that they were going to broadcast, revealing this side of Perot, the side that they saw up close, or at least as close as they were able to get, because Perot was actually not running a conventional campaign. Before they were able to get any of these stories on the air virtually, Perot dropped out. In fact, the day Perot dropped out was the day that their first investigative piece was scheduled to run. And it was scrapped because at 11 o'clock in the morning on the eve of the Democratic Convention, Perot announced that he was dropping out of the race. And so all this material, hours and weeks and months of work was sort of just scrapped.
You think there was any coincidence there?
My guess is not.
Yeah. Is there any, like, big moral you think we take away from the 92 campaign and the coverage of it?
I do. I think that the moral is that the public is more interested in the substance of what candidates are doing and what they stand for than the press gives them credit for. The problem with the press's cynicism about the process is that we're cynical about the public and their appetite for information. And if we decide that they're not interested in anything but entertainment and we start to provide them with merely entertainment, they will turn away from journalism and turn away from public life because there are more entertaining things than reading the newspaper or watching the news.
Tom Rosenstiel, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tom Rosenstiel is media and political correspondent for the LA Times. His new book is called Strange Bedfellows. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.